You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute and review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. So we're joined today by Dr. Steven Reber, who's a program manager at IARPA, the Intelligence Advanced Research Project Activity, in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, where he leads the CREATE program, which is developing methods to improve the reasoning and analytic products. Before joining IARPA, Dr. Reber worked at ODNI's Analytic Integrity and Standards Group, where he led efforts to improve analytic tools, training, and metrics. At AIS, he launched the Intelligence Community Prediction Market, developed Analysis 101, the intelligence community's first joint training course for new analysts, and led the development of a standardization test for critical thinking and intelligence analysis. Dr. Reber received his PhD in philosophy from Princeton University, which proves you can get a good job with just about any degree. And he was a professor at Georgia State University before coming to the intelligence community, where he served as a scholar in residence at CIA's Kent School for Intelligence Analysis prior to joining ODNI. Welcome, Stephen. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
Thanks, Vince. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm interested to see, I mean, you're a professor, you have a PhD in philosophy. What brought you to the IC? And that seemed to be a kind of a mid-career transfer of something relatively straightforward, it started academia, to a job at the highest levels, the ODNI, of the intelligence community.
Yeah, thanks for asking the question. As you said, I was a professor of philosophy at Georgia State University for 9 years when I abruptly decided to make a career change. And what led me to do that, although I was very happy teaching philosophy and I imagined that I would continue doing it until my retirement, one day I changed my mind. And that day was, as you might guess, 9/11. I remember saying to a friend with whom I spoke that evening, I think I'm going to join the CIA. So that was my goal. It took some time because the intelligence services, the intelligence agencies in this country don't generally seek out philosophers for employment. So I had to make a case for why they should hire me. My first job was as a visiting scholar, a scholar in residence at the Kent Center for Analytic Tradecraft, which is part of the was part of the Kent School of CIA. And there I introduced CIA analysts and IC intelligence community analysts more broadly to new analytic methods, new ways of thinking, with the goal that I retain to this day of trying to improve analysis in intelligence.
Was it analysis is not new. I mean, analysis of intelligence information has been going on for centuries. Mm-hmm. And basically, we've been doing it the same way that whole time. I think the misperception of the public about analysts is that they kind of just smart people that think around and sit around and think about stuff and try to figure out what it all means. I mean, certainly that is what it is in the most basic sense. But how have you come in and kind of rocked the boat? How have analytic arguments been basically the same since the formation of the CIA? Why do we need to do something and change them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Sort of a two-part question. Why is change needed and what changes have been effected? So on the first part, why is change needed? I think we a good illustration, actually, is a recent major intelligence failure, which was the Iraq weapons of mass destruction estimate that the intelligence community made in 2002. The commission that was established to look into this intelligence failure said that it was primarily a failure of analysis, that it wasn't so much an inability to acquire the information, collection, as we call it in intelligence, but rather putting together the implications of the information that was collected. So a quote from the WMD Commission, Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, is that the intelligence community reached the mistaken conclusions that it did about particularly Iraq's alleged nuclear weapons program because of, quote, it was trying to fit the evidence to the prevailing assumptions. Now, in making that accusation, that criticism, I'm sure that the WMD Commission was not presuming that the IC is unique in this respect.
Right.
Cognitive psychologists for the last 30 or 40 years have been finding ways in which human beings, including highly educated, highly sophisticated human beings, tend to make systematic errors in reasoning. So reasoning can be improved, and the WMD failure is evidence that it needs to be improved.
Well, hasn't understanding cognitive biases been foundational to intelligence analysis going back decades? I mean, we know we mirror image as human beings. We know we have confirmation bias as human beings. We know we anchor. All these different cognitive biases that analysts are aware of, and haven't they been taught, Jesus, for decades how to get around those, how to identify those and make them to where they don't affect their work?
That's a great question. And the short answer is yes. Analysts at many of the agencies are taught about the scientific evidence on cognitive biases and how we need to try to combat them, you know, internally. They're also given structured analytic techniques, methods and tools to help the analyst counter the biases. There are a couple of problems with that widely practiced prescription. One is that many of the techniques, though widely taught and widely endorsed by the intelligence agencies and others, have very little evidence of their effectiveness. A National Academy of Sciences study found that a few years ago, that there are many techniques that are recommended to help counter cognitive biases, to help improve thinking, but the research basis under them is very thin. So that's one problem. A second problem, and I discovered this firsthand in the intelligence community in trying to get structured analytic methods taught and used. And the bottom line is it's pretty easy to teach them. It's very hard to get analysts to use them. And if you think about it, being an intelligence analyst, it's easy to understand why that is. They're very busy. They have a traditional, a standard way of doing things. A lot of information is coming in. They have production that they have to get out. And to stop and think about their thinking,
right,
to apply a structured technique that's somewhat unfamiliar, maybe not that appealing, is a big request to make of intelligence analysts. So getting it back to CREATE, one thing that we said at the very beginning when we announced the request for proposals for the CREATE program at IARPA is that we want not just analytic tools that will improve thinking, but what might be even harder, a greater challenge, is analytic tools that intelligence analysts will willingly use.
Right. It doesn't do any good if you make some amazing tool that no one is going to adopt because it's too hard or too difficult or it's too different from what they're used to doing.
Right.
I'm wondering about groupthink. I mean, groupthink is one of these cognitive biases that seems to be prevalent throughout the IC. I mean, talk about WMD. There's a good example of kind of everyone just kind of going along with it. How have earlier ways of doing analysis really emphasized the problem about consensus and about the ability to go against the consensus of the group? So that seemed to be a problem that's almost unsolvable, or at least kind of, you know, on face value, it seems to be an unsolvable problem.
Yeah, let me say something about that. So the term groupthink was invented by, or coined by, Irving Janis, and it has a very specific and a broader application. So in the very specific meaning, groupthink is this tendency that small groups have to coalesce on a certain view and discourage dissent. But there's another sense in which groupthink means just a tendency, as you pointed out, for people to too narrowly zero in on a particular point of view and be reinforced by their colleagues. The intelligence community seeks, in its traditional methods, to combat the latter form of groupthink by encouraging, when it produces national intelligence estimates, NIEs as they're known, dissenting agencies to write a response outlining the reason they don't agree with the majority position. So there are ways that the intelligence community currently uses to try to counter groupthink. There are new ways, too, that have been introduced recently. One of them, if you don't mind, I'll say something about the intelligence community prediction market. So some of your listeners may be familiar with prediction markets generally because they've become fairly widespread in the last decade or so. A prediction market basically is a way to bet on future events, future possible events. So if one of the questions on the market is, will these two countries go to war by the end of the year, two specific countries, and you think the answer is yes, you can drive the price up, you know, like the stock market value. And if you're right, you win points or money on the outcome of the event. And then you get more to play with, to bet with later. A few years ago, the intelligence community introduced an internal prediction market for use by any of its analysts and other officers. It's widely used by the intelligence community. I should mention that there's no money involved, no cash payments. We're not in violation of any anti-gambling laws.
Yeah, people out there going, the deep state is betting on this.
And what I want to bring it back to your question about groupthink, because prediction markets work on an interesting and somewhat counterintuitive principle known as the wisdom of crowds. And the idea is that if you take a lot of people's estimates, especially on a quantitative question, like when will something happen, and you average them, the average is often more accurate than just about any of the individual guesses or estimates. It's that finding is somewhat counterintuitive to us Americans because we tend to think of average as not very good.
Right.
Wisdom of crowd says, no, average can actually be better. So the prediction market makes use of the wisdom of crowds principle. And in addition, getting it back to groupthink, the prediction market provides a strong incentive for any individual participant to bet against the crowd if she thinks that she has information to the contrary.
Right.
So it incentivizes dissenting opinion. How? Because if you know something that other people don't, just like in the stock market, if you have inside information, figuratively, and you know some, or you're making better use of information that other people have, you can draw the inferences correctly from it, then you can use that information, profit on the prediction market because you're more likely to get it right.
It sounds an awful lot like when you talk about the average of what Nate Silver and 538 and kind of that statistical analytical method for everything from sports to politics has been doing now for years. And I mean, I think Nate Silver himself in the 2008 election predicted like 98% of the seats available by using the averages of all the different polling data and everything else.
Right.
He didn't do so well in 2016, but then again, no one really did.
Exactly.
Except for the 2% of people that predicted that the outlier that predicted the election going the way it was. How much for the listener out there who may know kind of the sports advanced analytic world or the election analytic worlds we do in Washington, D.C., a lot of people are paying attention to that. How similar are these things?
Sorry, you mean the internal and the external prediction markets?
Well, more about like how people are doing predictions based on, you know, whether one team is going to beat another team or one candidate is going to beat another candidate. I mean, the day of the 2016 presidential election, New York Times, with Nate Silver working with them, had Hillary Clinton winning by like 96% chance she was going to win. And that was an aggregate of polling data, an average of polling data from around the country. Are these kind of things doing the same thing as what you've been talking about?
Yeah. So we've actually collected data on the accuracy of the IC prediction market. And the brief answer is that it's done pretty darn well. Not a great deal more accurate than traditional analytic forecasts. But in general, on average, and then we're talking here about averages, somewhat more accurate than traditional analytic methods. So that is something that we're concerned with, and we're constantly collecting data on that, on its accuracy.
So we're basically, intelligence analysis is pretty damn good now, but we want to make it better.
Yes, exactly.
So let me ask you about an earlier program that kind of predates this, the CREATE program. That's IARPA's Aggregative Contingent Estimation. Why is it got to be so hard? ACE.
ACE.
The research program. So we know a little bit about this, the Good Judgment Project out of the University of Pennsylvania, where an extraordinary outcome of comparing some of the best analysts in the world versus crowdsourced analysts. And they beat the pants off of the people who were considered kind of professional analysts.
Yeah, the ACE program, it is easier to say ACE than the fully spelled out version of the name, was sponsored, as you say, by IARPA. What it was meant to do was to go beyond traditional crowdsourced methods like prediction markets and do even better than those wisdom of crowds methods. And it did that in a number of ways. It developed some training courses, I mean short courses, they just take a couple of hours. It found that if you weight the judgments, giving more credit to people who have been accurate in the past, you can increase the overall aggregate accuracy. And the third thing that it did, which was a surprise to the researchers as well as to IARPA, was it found, as is illustrated by the name of the book that Philip Tetlock wrote on the basis of this, Super Forecasting, it found that some people have unusual skill at forecasting accurately. That is to say, they may not be subject matter experts, but rather they're very good at making accurate forecasts across a range of topics. So that was an interesting surprise that the ACE program yielded.
Well, even more, you talk about some people. We're not talking about seasoned CIA analysts. We're talking about someone out in Montana or someone that's not an average yokel, but somebody with high levels of intelligence.
Right.
But someone that does not have a job working for the intelligence community.
Right. Yeah. Now, it's widely believed, and I want to correct this a little bit. It's widely believed that the ACE program showed that ordinary people can forecast more accurately than intelligence analysts.
Yeah, I'm glad you're bringing this up. So good.
Right. So in a way, that's true, and in a way, it isn't. What that simple statement overlooks is that the ordinary people in the ACE program had the benefit of some of the interventions that ACE was developing. Like I mentioned, the training, the weighting, the higher weighting to certain forecasts of people who have been accurate in the past. So it isn't exactly a level playing field between the two.
Right. It's not just some guy thinking about stuff like, why do we need analysts at CIA if Bob in Minnesota can do this? There's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah. And so, if I may say one more thing about ACE, currently, as a result of the ACE program and the insights that it yielded, we're incorporating some of the findings into the IC prediction market. And that's really the goal of all this research that IARPA does. We develop things often in the unclassified world using volunteers if it involves human subjects. And we want to take the things that work, not everything does at IARPA, and incorporate them into IC intelligence community practices. And we're doing that with ACE.
Well, so how is CREATE building upon what you've done in the past?
In a way, CREATE is different. So CREATE is new in a way. Let's see, if I could state it this way, that CREATE is trying to do for analytic reasoning what ACE and prediction markets did for forecasting. So what we're trying to do in CREATE, and we're early in the program, we're only about a year and a half into a 4.5-year long program. We're in phase one. What we're trying to do in CREATE is develop crowdsourced analytic methods that people can easily use to produce well-reasoned arguments, not simply forecasts like an ACE, where the output of ACE and the IC prediction market, for that matter, is simply a number. This is the percentage probability of that event. In CREATE, in a way, it's more ambitious because CREATE is trying to develop methods to help analysts produce the analytic product, the report that comes out of their thinking and all of their analysis. So it's really, it has a broader aim than the ACE program.
Well, because a lot of people look at collection and analysis as the, kind of the two key parts of intelligence work. But unless you can convey what you've analyzed, the kind of the final product to a policymaker or to someone who's making decisions, then it doesn't matter how good your collection is. It doesn't matter how good your analysts are. So are you saying that what CREATE is trying to do is make a finished product in a better way so that when policymakers get a hold of it, they can understand not only things like, you know, probability of this being true, like, you know, a high confidence versus medium confidence, but also kind of the communication, that step that communicates to a not very well-trained policymaker, probably, like a member of Congress from somewhere that doesn't know the background, and try to get those points across. I mean, how much of that dissemination part of the intelligence cycle is CREATE focused on?
Great. It's actually both. I would take issue, if you don't mind, with your description of. I agree that some consumers of intelligence aren't highly educated, but some are. And actually, as you know, one challenge that analysts face is that when they brief a policymaker, often the policymaker has real expert knowledge of that situation. So to get back to your point about communication, it's for both audiences, the people who don't know very much about the issue, of whom there are a lot, and the people who are really expert in it. So in answer to your question, CREATE is trying to improve the communication of the reasoning, but that's not its primary goal. That's important, but the primary goal of CREATE is to help analysts reason better, think more clearly, more accurately, gain more insight about the issue itself, so that then whatever product that they write will be informed by that good thinking.
Well, how does this concept of crowd wisdom and kind of division of labor and allowing these different groups of analysts to contribute information, how does that lead to an individual thinking better?
Good. Yeah, let me talk about that for a minute. And I should preface this by saying, applying good scientific method here, that these are our hypotheses. We're not sure that this will work, and that's what IARPA does, is to test things. So you asked, how could crowdsourcing help lead to better thinking, better reasoning? There are a couple of ways that seem intuitively plausible. One is that, as we all know, it's very helpful to talk with somebody who takes a different point of view from ours.
Doesn't happen too often anymore.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think you're right. That polarization, political polarization, reduces the people's ability to engage in those conversations with people who disagree. But it still happens sometimes, and we know from experience that you learn a lot. That I know that if I talked, say, going back to my graduate student days with my PhD advisor, and I asserted something in my draft, he would point out exactly where I was wrong, and that was the best information that I could get. Wrong meaning that my thinking wasn't that clear about it. So that's one way. A second way that crowds larger than just interactions, say, with a couple of people might help, is that the CREATE tool, whatever comes out of CREATE, should enable the analysts, including analysts at different agencies, to divide the labor so that an analyst at NGA who has a particular insight might add something to the product that they're all jointly working on. An analyst at NSA might counter that and might raise another point on a related topic. Finally,
so it really looks like it's trying to break down the silos between these agencies. And that's interesting to me because the big criticism of the ODNI, I mean, there are several, but one of the big ones is that it hasn't broken down those silos as well as it was intended to do. Back when it was created, the ERTPA or whatever, 2004,
right.
The idea of this interagency cooperation at that level has not really been realized yet. This sounds like that's trying to shatter, at least on the analytical side, the kind of individual silos of these agencies.
Yeah, I would put it in a slightly more measured terms because I agree with the basic point that CREATE is trying to produce methods that analysts across the 16 agencies can effectively use to work together to produce a product. However, it's not part of CREATE's aim to displace traditional ways of doing analysis. Again, the analogy is the IC prediction market. And it actually serves that function because analysts across the agencies make forecasts, they post comments, they disagree with one another. So it's a very nice, in a way, grassroots effort to enable the mission of the ODNI, which is integrating the intelligence community. But analysts still make forecasts in the traditional way, and the ICBM certainly doesn't threaten that. Similarly, the methods that come out of CREATE, if they enable, as I hope they will, analysts to cooperate on producing an analytic product online, jointly, in a crowdsourced way, that should live side by side with the traditional way of doing analysis.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Are you expecting, or have you seen, since it's been going on for a year, are you expecting that not just kind of the final product of analysis is being challenged, but even like the underlying assumptions? Is this something where you might post something and let's use the model you said with NGA versus NSA, where the NSA guy might come with his own information, but also might go after the underlying assumptions and say, I think you've got too far on bad assumptions. Is that kind of allowing these interagency analysts to kind of challenge each other at a fundamental level?
Absolutely. That is exactly, yeah, one purpose that I hope, and I have to keep saying hope because nothing has been tested coming out of CREATE. We're about to do that. But that's one of the things that I hope comes out of it. I can give you an example, actually, going back to the Iraq WMD case and the nuclear weapons. So at the time, and again, this all is in the WMD Commission report, at the time, the intelligence community in 2002 realized that there were two hypotheses about the aluminum tubes, if people remember that. One key piece of evidence and that the IC used to make its judgment that Iraq was reconstituting its nuclear weapons program was these high-strength aluminum tubes that it was trying to procure. Intelligence community knew this. There were two hypotheses. The IC recognized this. One was, what were the tubes for? They were for nuclear centrifuges. That was one. The other was they were for conventional rockets, nothing to do with a nuclear weapons program. The WMD Commission says that IC was absolutely wrong in its judgment about rockets because the intelligence community judged that these aluminum tubes that Iraq was trying to get were not suitable for conventional rockets. And of course, that led the IC to support its judgment that they were for nuclear purposes. Here's something that you can imagine a CREATE user doing with the tool that comes out of CREATE. The intelligence community is looking at that question. Are these aluminum tubes suitable for conventional rockets? Had that question been asked explicitly, then some analyst in one of the agencies might have said, wait a second, let's look at that. Have any other countries used this special high-strength aluminum for conventional rockets? And if they had asked that question, they would have found, according to the commission, that over a dozen other countries had already used those tubes for conventional rockets. So you can imagine the analyst who asked the key question, another analyst answers it, And ideally, that key piece of information challenging one of the assumptions would have greatly reduced the confidence that the intelligence community had that the tubes were not suitable for rockets.
This seems like a much more dynamic process than just kind of collection coming to an analyst, the analyst figuring out what it means and then sending it on. Are there timetable concerns with this? This seems like it takes a lot longer. Now, you want to get it right, obviously, but this seems to take, this might take a lot longer to put together a finished product if it's sent across the board. People are challenging assumptions. Now, great, getting it right is important, but a lot of times I can think of analytical processes that might take 2 hours, where an analyst is told, here's the information, you have 2 hours to write this up and you got to go brief somebody.
Right.
Doesn't seem that this might work for that process.
That's a great point, because you're absolutely right that intelligence analysts work under a variety of pressure. Sometimes the real pressure is the time constraint. And you're right to say that it really varies. So, you know, for an NIE, there may be a couple of months to produce it or more. For a short turnaround product, absolutely has to go out the door. I'll mention now, and I could talk about this more, that in CREATE, we have four different research teams producing very different analytic tools. Some of them take a fair amount of time for the analyst to use. Others can be used very quickly. So this is one of those variables that we want to keep in mind. I think you're right that speed really matters to intelligence analysts. And what I imagine coming out of CREATE will be usable very quickly by different analysts. Because you can imagine doing this. You post the question, it immediately goes online for all the analysts in the community interested in that issue. Somebody can immediately, post a response with a link to a report saying, here's some information bearing on it. Somebody at another agency can say, wait a second, but you're assuming X, and I have information against X. So if you think of CREATE as yielding a structured online, well-reasoned communication or conversation, then that is something that you can imagine proceeding very rapidly.
Just so the listener, most of them will know this, but we're not talking about something that you at home can Google. We're talking about a very specific online when you're talking about online, which is the internal communications within the IC, not broader.
Exactly.
What about when, I mean, classification is not going to matter all that much because you are talking about internal communication in the IC. But even there are times when all analysts are not the same when it comes to their access to information. With nuclear weapons, you're talking about needing a Q clearance, the levels higher than others. Is that going to mitigate some of the benefits of this system to where the really hard questions, talk about Iraqi WMD, there were people that had to be particularly cleared at levels that they may not be able to get access into these kind of questions and these kind of programs?
Yeah, good question. In my experience in the intelligence community, and I think this is another benefit of establishing the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the majority of analysts have access to more or less the same information. Now, there is what's called compartmented information that only a small number of analysts have access to. And I just have to agree with you that the CREATE tool is not going to solve that problem any more than any other tool. So you're right that the conversation that I was describing and imagining occurring in the structured CREATE method will not be able to exceed certain classification levels, but a large number of Intel analysts have access to the same amount of material.
Let me ask you an inside baseball question. Let's say CREATE finishes the multi-year program and you found some really great ways to change the way analysts do analysis. How likely is it that these will be adopted? Like, what is the mandate here? Is this, if you come back with clear and concise evidence that there's a better way of doing it? I mean, think of bureaucracy in Washington and everything else. And not just that, the bureaucracy of these intelligence agencies that have been around for decades and doing it the same way for decades. How quickly does this behemoth move? And how likely is it that if these are if they're very good results from this, that we'll actually see some changes? That may be an unfair question.
No,
I'm sorry.
It's an excellent question because, as I mentioned earlier, I came to the intelligence community not with the idea of managing scientific research, but with the goal of improving actual practices. And that's true of IARPA generally. We're not just interested in research for its own sake. We want to see the practices get adopted and get used. So it's an excellent question, and it really matters. I think that the IoT prediction market that I was describing earlier serves as a model for how create tools might get used. It's not the only model, but it's, I guess you might call it a sort of democratic process as opposed to top-down. It's a bottom-up method where we made the IoT prediction market software available. Any analyst anywhere can use it, and they do because they find it interesting and engaging, and they follow it. Something similar might happen with Create. And I actually think that that's more likely than, as you said, there being a mandate by an agency or across all agencies to demand that Intel analysts use the method. Moreover, forcing somebody to use a tool that they're disinclined to use may have unintended adverse consequences, like they may not use it in the proper way. They may just make a show of it. Not because Intel analysts are more likely to do that than anybody else, but because they're professionals and they don't want, they'll resist attempts to, in a heavy-handed way, control their behavior. So again, back to your point, I think it's not very likely that there will be a decree, even if the evidence on Create tools is excellent, that they really work. I don't think that the Intel community or any particular agency will mandate the use of the tools. What I hope will happen is that a small number of intelligence analysts will try them out, find them useful, word will spread, and use will grow.
Let me ask a question. Your sister agency, I guess for lack of a better term, DARPA, mm-hmm. has been around a lot longer than you have, but there's been a lot of trickle-down DARPA projects into the civilian world, you know, talking about everything from the internet to GPS and all the materials engineering and everything else. This sounds like something that would be very useful within the civilian world. I mean, even going back to your prior career about teaching logic in philosophy classes, these kind of ideas in a broader sense of kind of crowdsourcing arguments and analysis seems like something that should be taught in critical thinking classes and from high school on up. Do you hope or do you think that possibly some of these programs down the road might begin to change the way we teach critical thinking, mm-hmm. change the way we teach logic, we teach rhetoric and debate and argument moving forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there's a narrow version and a wider version. I don't think that Create will do much to change the training of critical thinking or reasoning. But what I do hope is that it will change the practice. Because, as you mentioned when you were going over my bio, I was involved in developing Analysis 101, a critical thinking and other things training course for intelligence analysts. And Create, however, is different because we're not so much trying to teach people to think better as give them tools that are easy to use, that analytic tools that enable them as a group, a crowd, to think more accurately and more clearly. So in response to your question, I think it would be wonderful, and I know that IARPA generally supports its technologies finding wider use. It would be wonderful if the legal profession or medicine or science or public policy had access to and used effective tools, analytic tools that come out of Create.
So you talked about you're in the middle of phase one now, and you have been for a little while. So can you talk us through the process behind this program? It doesn't have to be kind of uber inside baseball and nuts and bolts, mm-hmm. but what are the phases? What are we trying to do? When is this going to wrap itself up? And how does the public out there, if they're listening, follow along with this process? This is something you can find on the IARPA website. This is not highly classified.
Right.
This is something that can be followed by the average person out there.
Yeah, happy to talk about that. So first, where we are in the process, we're coming towards the end of phase one, and we have four, just to give you some of the IARPA jargon here, in case I fall into it unexpectedly, we have, and DARPA uses this as well, performer teams are the research teams that actually conduct the research and develop the tools. And then we have what's called a test and evaluation team, T&E, that independently assesses their effectiveness, the effectiveness of the tools. So we have four performer teams at in CREATE, they actually are all universities, though IARPA often sponsors research by companies as well. I'll name them. One of them is LOCO, George Mason University. The second is Syracuse University. And two are actually based in Australia, University of Melbourne and Monash University. Each one, as I mentioned, of these research or performer teams is pursuing its own approach, developing an analytic tool that we're about to start testing. So we're in the process now of recruiting people from the public. All you need is you need to be able to speak English fluently, be at least 18 years of age, and have at least some college, and be willing to put into the time to test the tools. So we're going to give people and create phase one fictional problems where we kind of control all the information that's out there. They use one or more of these analytic tools to try to solve the problem. The test and evaluation team will evaluate the quality of reasoning, the quality of argumentation in the product, the report that the people write using the tools, and if the performer team that developed that tool gets people using it to write well-reasoned arguments, to reason effectively, then they get credit for that. So that's the basic idea. And it's, as I said, the first of three phases. At the end of this phase, we may renew some of the contracts with one or more teams that did unusually well in the first phase. And it goes for a total of 4.5 years. Oh, you asked as well, Vince, about how people can find out about it.
Yeah.
IARPA really is a scientific organization, and we believe in sharing our scientific findings widely. So if you go to the IARPA website, you can find for any program, like CREATE, scientific publications, links to them that have come out of it. So that's a good way to find out at a scientific level what's been happening.
So for a lot of the interviews you may have done in the past, you're probably speaking to a lay audience, and you want to recruit all those lay audience people. Right? So the kind of, that's your perfect test case.
Yep.
For our audience, we may have somebody out there who's in the director of operations at CIA. Mm-hmm. Are they precluded from being involved in this because they have an intelligence background? I mean, is that someone that would be not able to sign up to work in this program?
No, they are not precluded. And in fact, I know that some people with intelligence backgrounds have signed up to participate in CREATE. Now, it goes without saying that if someone works in operations or something like that, they should think hard about whether they want to be associated on the internet
right.
with the intelligence community, but they know that as well as I do.
Yeah.
But no, we're very interested in testing the analytic tools that come out of CREATE on a wide range of people, and I think it'll be fascinating to see whether people with intel backgrounds, including we're actually recruiting people who are studying intelligence studies at various universities within the U.S. and elsewhere to see whether people with an intelligence orientation react to the tools differently mm-hmm. from the general public.
So other than, going to the website, the IARPA website, is there a specific way? Will they figure it out once they get there about how to sign up for this? Or is there a particular URL or something that you can give them?
Thank you for asking.
I'll let you know that when we do the blurb for this, when this posts, we'll actually have this URL in the written part of this. But for people that are driving or anything else and they want to hear it, can you lay it out for us?
Yep. The URL to find out about the program and how to test some of these analytic tools is join.createbetterreasoning.com. That's join.createbetterreasoning, all one word, .com.
Let me go broader than that. That people will have that to where you can hear it, because people might be thinking, all right, this sounds cool, but I don't have a lot of time right now. But there are all sorts of, you can kind of give a writ large advertisement for your other program managers out there. But there are programs like this all the time, not necessarily crowdsource stuff, mm-hmm. but things that IARPA is doing that may involve the public. So even if someone doesn't think they have the time, like they're writing a dissertation, they may not have the time to do this right now. There will be opportunities in the future, and maybe you'll be the PM for it, maybe somebody else, where people can get involved in what IARPA is doing.
Absolutely. And our public affairs office is very good in disseminating information about upcoming and ongoing IARPA projects where people can get involved. You're right. So I hadn't really thought about it that way. But from the point of view of a listener who's not part of the intelligence community and not a scientist, there are two things that you might be interested in. That one is just what is IARPA doing? What's it coming up with? What is it learning? And the second is, how can I get involved? And so, yeah, if you go to our website, you'll see ways beyond CREATE that people can volunteer for.
Dr. Stephen Reber has been with us. He's a program manager at IARPA in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today. In all honesty, guys out there, check out this CREATE program. It may not be for you, but I think for a lot of you, this is going to be a nice, interesting way that you can get involved in helping the intelligence community and kind of learning a little bit about yourself, really, when it comes down to it. So please check out the website. I'll have it posted online and everything else so you can see what you can possibly do to get involved. So thank you, Stephen, for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Vince. It's been a pleasure.